I'm Doug Osborne.
And I'm Michael Smith. Welcome to our podcast, which is presented by Assured Partners Investment Advisors,
where we talk investing and all things related in a way you can understand.
Woo-hoo!
Hi, this is Chuck.
This is Michael. It's Thursday, July 17th, 2025. This is the 20th episode of our podcast.
Woo-hoo!
Chuck, what's on your mind?
Patrick Henry. Michael, Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death.
It's time.
There we go. We're in the month of July. We just celebrated our nation's birthday. We're in the 250th year now, and it's a good time to remember that liberty and freedom is our nation's founding virtue, and liberty, frankly, is under attack, especially economic liberty. So that's where we are.
Well, Chuck, why does freedom and what does freedom, impact markets? This is an investing podcast, right? So markets, the stock market, what's the connection there and why is it so important?
Right. Exactly. Why are we talking about this? Well, frankly, Michael, it affects everything we do. Our system, our free market system is the reason that we, have a stock market that we invest in. It's the reason that we have retirement plans, and it's the reason that people have the ability to have their own unique financial plan and pursue their own goals. Again, one of our inalienable rights is the right to pursuit of happiness. And that, means you can pursue your goals, financial and otherwise. And everything we do for our clients, everything our clients do for investing, really relies on that. And I think sometimes we don't think about that when we see, things that frankly threaten that future.
Well, when economists talk about the market, right? I think everyone always thinks they're talking about the stock market. But what is the market to an economist from a high level?
Right. That's a great question. And I think it comes up because you've got comments like on the right. You have got comments from people like J.D. Vance who have said things like he's criticized conservatives who he claims worship. And these are his words, the capital M market. I don't think any economist actually put a capital M in front of the word market, but nor does anyone actually worship it. But that's, in our view, kind of a misunderstanding of what a free market economy actually is. And the market, from an economic standpoint, is simply each individual person being able to make their own economic decisions, so they are free to make their own economic decisions. I think you're right. I think most people actually think of the stock market, and a stock market, it would be part of a market economy. But, but really the lemonade stand, we're in the summertime, that might be a better example of the actual free market. When your neighbor's child decides that they want to go out and set up a stand and sell lemonade, they are free to do that. And they can go out and they can sell the lemonade and you can go buy it. And that's of your free choice. And when everyone's at the lemonade stand, there's, everyone's happy. Let's face it. I mean, the kids are having a great experience. They're maybe making a little spending money, having a good life experience. The adults are there, and most likely the lemonade's not all that great, but they're getting their thirst quenched. They're having fun. They're supporting, neighborhood children, and everyone wins in that situation. And that's really what happens in free markets is that, all economic activity is really voluntary and it is a win-win situation. Everyone involved wins. And I think a lot of people who say things against a free market society simply don't understand that.
Yeah, and so the reason we're kind of doing this, in defense, in defense of freedom, as you know, that was the main core of our quarterly newsletter, right? That we're talking about. And
sure.
The reason about this is because, you know, economic freedom, free markets are under attack, and you know, this is not a political issue, right? They're under attack by elements of what you would think of the left, which is Democrats. They're under attack by elements of the right, which we would think of as Republicans. This is not like a, oh, Democrats are doing this, socialists are getting us, and let's get the Democrat situation. This is apolitical. It's happening across political spectrums. They're having this issue. It happens to be that it's really in focus right now because in New York you have a Democratic politician who's running who is a self-described socialist. And so,
right.
You know, he's literally let's seize the means of production, but we're seeing it on the right. And I think it makes sense to talk about this, why it's not about left or right, and it's happening kind of across the board here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of that is there's a lot of confusion out there on what capitalism is, and there's also a lot of confusion out there on what socialism actually is. And, you know, granted, you know, definitions of words can evolve and can be used in different ways. There are certainly politicians, especially in Europe, who kind of refer to themselves as democratic socialists and so forth. But socialism, you know, textbook definition is not a political system. It is an economic system. You know, its counter is not democracy. Its counter is capitalism. And socialism is the state ownership of the means of production. And so what that means is that we're no longer free to do what we want to do. We would no longer live in a free market capitalist society. We would live in a society where the government decides, what you can do from an economic standpoint. And the thing about Mamdani, which is unique because there have been other Democratic politicians who have kind of flirted with socialism in the past, and he's just flat out come out and said it, and that this is his end goal. He wants to take over the means of production. He's talking about the government taking over all the grocery stores in New York, et cetera. That is what socialism actually is. And you are correct. It's not political. So if you look in our history of socialist countries, it actually started in Germany. And, you know, in Nazi Germany was a socialist country. I mean,
it was politically on the right.
Correct. Correct.
It was politically on the right, but there was a socialist country by economic nature.
Yeah, I mean, Germany was socialist before the Nazis got elected, but they maintained that socialist economic system. Their official title was the National Workers Socialist Party. That's who they were. And the state maintained control of the means of production. That is socialism. As a matter of fact, Hayek's famous book, The Road to Serfdom, really, you know, if for those who haven't read that book, it is a warning for the future, but it's largely the story of what actually happened in Germany and how Germany, who was considered to be the most advanced nation on the planet, fell victim to this horrible Nazi regime and, you know, and had all kinds of horrors in the middle part of the 20th century. And so, you know, that was an example of socialism. Obviously, the Soviet Union was also an example of socialism, as was China, Cambodia. I mean, you go down the list, Cuba. They're all of these countries, whether they be communist, fascist, whatever, their economic system was socialism. And that's what socialism actually is. It is an economic system. It's not a, by textbook is not a political system.
Yeah, and the reason that we're keying on freedom is because at the end of the day, from an economic standpoint, if you are a socialist system, you are not free as an individual to make your own economic decisions. You can't choose what you're necessarily going to use as you're a producer in the system. If you are a business, you can't produce what you're going to produce. You can't choose what you're going to produce. As a consumer, you can't necessarily choose what you're going to consume. And the fact that you take individuals' freedom outside of that causes worse outcomes at the end of the day.
You're absolutely right, Michael. And, the other thing, and of course, in the case of Mamdani, that is a relatively extreme example. But really, any of the criticism of capitalism, and there's lots of critics of capitalism right now on both sides of the political aisle. As Milton Friedman said, any true criticism of capitalism is really a critique on freedom itself. What they're actually arguing is that you don't deserve to be free, because when people are free, they're not making the decisions that I deem to be correct. When people have free will to do what they want to in a marketplace, whether that be the marketplace for stocks and where capital moves, or whether that be the marketplace for lemonade or any other economic item that we have, you're criticizing people's freedom to make those decisions. And that's really what critiques against capitalism are. And in my opinion, I would add one other category in there, and I think we hear a lot of this today, is that you have the critiques, the traditional kind of academic critiques of capitalism, are really critiques against freedom. There are those that don't believe that people deserve to be free. They do not have the faith in human beings. The second critique against capitalism is what you hear a lot today, the phrase, the economy is not working for people. And to me, this is a critique of ignorance. This is a critique of, you call it capitalism because you're using examples in America, and you think of America as being a capitalist country. But the specific things that people tend to complain about are usually the areas in the economy where we have actually moved away from being capitalistic, where we've actually put more government control, and we're not allowing people to make their free decisions any longer.
Well, it's not as if we're, and everyone knows there are, we have problems as a capitalist society, right? It is not perfect. We're full of humans, no matter how you're looking at it, and humans make mistakes, and there is greed, and there's hubris, and there's all these things that humans have been throughout history, and whatever economic system you're going to be a part of, those elements of human nature are going to make themselves happen. But you can't, the truth of the matter is there's no way to completely get rid of those, and when you try to control people, the outcome actually ends up worse. And I think that's a good instance to talk here. So there, younger adults, people I think that came of age, they were teenagers and became adults, post 2008 and the great financial crisis, that's a group of people that are very disillusioned right now. They're right. Disillusioned because they think that the American dream, for a lot of reasons, has passed them by, and that maybe they can't have the same access to that their parents and people before them did. And there's some truth that there are certain things that are more difficult, but the reasons on why that are happening are what matters. And so I like to talk about kind of what I think are the big three pillars of this that happen a lot of times, which is, one is housing. Housing has gotten much more expensive, and housing is a bedrock of the American dream for a lot of people, and that's become out of the reach of some people, and we talk about why. And then affordable health care and education, right? The expense of both of those have gotten out of hand. And the devil's in the details. I think that's what we have to to talk right. about why these things have gotten expensive and why that's not really about capitalism and there's something else going on there.
Right. So housing is a great place to start. In fact, there was just an article just yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. As recently as 2021, the average monthly mortgage payment for the median house in America was just under $1,500 a month, so $1,500 a month. I think it was something like $1,440, something like that. And that's interesting to me because, to go back, this is an anecdotal story from my own life. In the early 90s, when I was a young professional here in Atlanta, I looked at a house and almost purchased it in a neighborhood you'd be familiar with, Michael. Some of our local listeners might be familiar with Peachtree Hills. Still a great neighborhood in Atlanta. And there was a house listed at that time for roughly about $150,000. And, you know, I ended up passing on that house, but I had run the numbers. The mortgage payment on that house for me would have been right at $1,500. You fast forward a decade, and one of my friends and coworkers at Invesco, when I was working for Invesco, lived in that neighborhood. That same house went on the market for almost $400,000. And what was interesting to me about that is because of the way interest rates had changed during that decade, the monthly payment would have been about $1,500.
And it was a $400,000 home.
Correct. So the monthly payment, you know, in the early 90s, when interest rates were, you know, close to 7, 8, 9% for a mortgage, was $1,500 for a $150,000 house. You know, all those years later, it appeared that the value of the house had increased dramatically. But when you think of housing the way the average person thinks of it, and they shouldn't, by the way, but that's a podcast for a different time. If you think of it as the monthly payment, it actually hadn't changed. You know, that was a $1,500 a month house. That's what that was.
Early, the first time you had it, you had interest expense here. You had principal here. You flipped later and you had it the other way with the principal payment higher, the interest payment was lower. But at the end of the day, the person that purchased that makes the same payment. But the price of the house quadruples over that time period.
Right. And that is all because the Fed had artificially lowered interest rates and held them down for a much longer period of time than they should have or needed to. And that is the impact of that Fed policy, that government policy.
And fast forward to the 2000s, when we went through an extended period of interest rates at absolutely rock bottom that you've never seen before for 10 years or more.
Right.
What happens to home prices at that point?
Right. You're artificially increasing the value of a home. A lot of people talked about, you know, the Fed lowered interest rates and there was no inflation. There actually was a lot of inflation, but those inflation went into assets, not into inflation.
Yeah.
Right. And specifically, they went into assets that are heavily levered, like homes, where almost everyone has a mortgage. Almost everyone borrows money to purchase a home. And therefore, that interest rate and whatever that monthly payment is really what drives the value or the market price of the home. And so the market didn't cause that house to go from 150 to 400,000. The Fed caused that house to go from 150 to 400 because that was what a $1,500 a month 30-year mortgage would pay for, you know, based on what was happening with interest rates. And the problem is now, you know, that really continued all the way up to 2021. And you still, you know, as the Wall Street Journal said, that would have been a pretty average mortgage. It was a pretty average you know, first home, that's what that was. It was $1,500 a month. Today, just 4 years later than 2021, the average median mortgage is about $2,600.
So why, Chuck, when in 2021, when we hit huge inflation after post-COVID and we had to raise rates to try to deal with that, why did the principal and cost, the home prices, not come back down some to get back into equilibrium?
Well, because you can't put that genie back in the bottle, Michael.
Right.
So, right. So, you know, home buyers are thinking in terms of what is my, you know, what is this mortgage payment going to be? Home sellers think, wait a second, I paid this for this house. I'm not going to sell it for less than that.
I'm not taking a loss on this.
Right. I'm not taking a loss on a house. And so, you know, once that's been inflated, it doesn't just go back into the bottle. And so as interest rates have basically come back to normal, what has ended up happening is a lot of young people can no longer afford houses. So, you know, interesting statistic, the average age now of a first-time home buyer is 38 years old. You know, you're almost old enough to have a midlife crisis before you're able to buy a house.
Well, I think we could go deeper, but I want to keep it a little bit shorter. But there's a lot of other reasons within home buying and why it's gotten more expensive from government regulation. You have things like the difficulty of pulling permits. You have looking even the tariff costs on lumber and how that does. There's a million different ways that government intervention causes the cost of new housing to go up, and it makes it very difficult to make new houses on the other end. But I think that's a little smaller. But I don't want to miss the other things, which is, Let's talk about healthcare a little bit too, and the issues
let's
there.
Let's stick there for a second, Michael.
Sure.
So, you're right, because the solution to the housing issue is that we need more houses. We need new houses. We need, almost nationwide, you need to be able to build houses, and you need houses that are beginner houses, starting houses.
Yeah.
You know, relatively small for young family that are affordable, so they get their foothold into that housing market. And but what causes that to be expensive is, as you said, the tariffs. So and again, this is an example of why this is not political. You know, if you're on the right, you have the tariffs on things like lumber. You raise the price of lumber, then the price of the house is going to go up. You know, you go back to the previous administration, we had a huge influx of new environmental regulations. All those environmental laws also make the cost of building the house much higher. And, you know, this is, I think, a great example of how you know, the intermingling between economics and politics. Now, politically, you know, our different listeners, y'all may agree with one or both of those policies. And you may think that that's a good idea, but both of them have a cost. And that's, you know, a lot of times what the politicians never talk about is the fact that, you know, there is a cost to going down these roads. And we may make the political decision that it's worth it as a society, but we are no longer simply allowing a free market to operate when we do that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, so then maybe move to a couple of the other pieces there, which is, you know, I think healthcare is a big one, and the cost of insurance and healthcare, you know, talk a little bit about that and how that works and why the market is so disconnected from reality there.
Sure. And, you know, the issue we have in healthcare with our country, and then again, I'm going to reference Hayek in that book, The Road to Serfdom. if our listeners have not read it, I think to me, it's a must read. But, you know, his book is a critique of socialism, why socialism is bad and why a free market society is superior. That's, you know, an oversimplification of that. But part of his book, he talks about the middle road. So, you know, and this really started in Europe, and a lot of places of Europe, they said, okay, well, we don't need to be as extreme as the socialists. We don't need actual government control of the means of production, all these things. But we want to go down kind of a middle path. And, he describes that middle path as the worst of both roads. And the reason is, and this is exactly what we've done in our healthcare system. So we have private health insurers, we have private hospitals, we have obviously private pharmaceutical companies, but they are completely regulated and controlled by the government. And what happens in that scenario is you end up with a lot of misalignment of interest. You have opaque costs where the end consumer doesn't get to actually see what is happening from a price perspective. The you have periods where an unscrupulous pharmaceutical company can gouge people because there is no price discovery, and you've got different layers of pricing going in. We all are aware of the game that doctors have to play with insurance companies in order to get paid. So the doctor will inflate the bill fairly dramatically, knowing the insurance company is not going to pay the whole amount, and then the insurance company is going to undercut that, and it all becomes this quagmire mess. And it's neither capitalistic nor socialist. It's this middle road that is really kind of the worst of both scenarios.
Yeah, I'd really love to just dive in on the price discovery idea, because that's such a bedrock of a market capitalist system. And it's, I don't think a lot of people understand how important that is. You made the comment that you don't know what the cost is or the prices of a lot of these things. And that's true, but also you've taken away the reason why it is important for a consumer to know that information, right? If you are paying for something, anything that's out there, and someone says this thing, an MRI, for instance, that you need on your knee is going to cost $2,000. And you're going to say, well, hey, that's a lot of money. So I'm going to go out there and find where the best place I can get this MRI is. You say it's going to cost me $2,000. Well, this person over here, 2 miles from me, will do it for $500. And it's the same thing. I'm going to go there and get it. So not only do I know the price, I impact myself. I know that I can save money by going here. That puts that action makes competition happen across the board. And so all of a sudden, all these people are competing. The costs of MRIs as a whole go down because they know that people are out there looking for MRIs. And so you have an automatic system in place to bring prices down to a level that the market can actually withstand and handle, where supply and demand are together. And when you take that away, the cost of the system goes through the roof. There is no natural way for cost to make any sense economically at all.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Michael. If you look at areas of our economy that do work, for example, like technology, the prices are always coming down. The services are always getting better. The access is always getting better, and there is huge downward pressure on pricing, and that's driven by competition. And it's driven by competition and the fact that we know exactly what price we're paying, and the consumer is able to make a wise decision. When you don't know the price, when there is no competition because the market's been completely regulated, then you have costs go out of hand, and that's exactly what's happened in our healthcare system.
Yeah, and that's the whole idea of, God, maybe it would be worth better compared to this combination that a capitalist system would be better, would be the best option there, because you would, and it worked forever when it was that way, right? But when you combine that level of regulation, you almost get a monster that's worse than both on their own, and that's what Hayek was yeah. talking about.
There's no almost about it, Michael. It's the middle path, as Hayek warned, is the worst of both options. If you think of, you know, the one path being socialism, the other path being capitalism, and then you go down the middle, that middle path is the worst.
Yeah, and then even education, which you've seen the cost of education skyrocket in a 20 to 30 year period, so much faster than inflation. That's also an unbelievably regulated area of the market where the government is practically, I mean, you know, these are practically government institutions, even though they call themselves private institutions, right?
Right. You think about this and the, you know, the soap opera that kind of happened earlier this year, and I guess to some degree it's still happening, although you don't see it in the news every day anymore, but the battle between the Trump administration and Harvard, and I, you know, I don't want to get in the middle of that, but just the facts. One, you know, there was an article comes out says that the administration is withholding $2 billion of, you know, payments to Harvard, and then threatened them with another billion. You know, these are billions with B's, Michael. And you're thinking Harvard is supposed to be this, you know, most prestigious private university, has an endowment of over $53 billion. Why are the taxpayers sending $3 billion? And that's just, you know, the scratching the surface. I don't even know what the total amount that taxpayers are sending to Harvard. And you're right. When that's happening, it's really no longer a private institution. It is a governmental institution. And that's now Harvard's, you know, maybe extreme, but that is true throughout higher education.
Well, yeah. And
and the cost, there's no justification for the cost of education being what it is. I mean, it really is. If it was any other industry, the college presidents would be brought in front of Congress and forced to testify because, you know, they'd be accused of price gouging and there would be people up in arms. But because it's education, we just put up with it. And so, you know, institutions like my own alma mater, who, you know, Wake Forest, and I love Wake Forest. I had a great education there, had a great experience. But it cost my dad roughly $10,000 a year to send me there. It's now, you know, all in, you know, basically $100,000. And, that's hard to fathom, especially if you think if it was just the forces of inflation, it should be roughly around 30,000, you know, in terms of, you know, what inflation has done in those 30 plus years.
Well, there's another issue too, and this happens also in the healthcare side, is when you kind of make big errors with how markets are supposed to naturally work, is that with education, the consumer is in a lot of ways not the person fitting the bill. They're not fitting the bill in that that's coming, a lot of that's being paid for by the government. So there's no price discovery there. There's no, the person who's actually paying is not the person consuming. Also, in a world where these loans have ballooned as large as they are, you know, they're, a lot of these kids that are putting these on, they don't ever think they're going to pay. They're going to be paying this over 10 years, over 20 years, over 30 years, and they don't even understand what they're paying. And so you get a situation where the person who's consuming it, again, has no reason to discover what a fair price for this product is, and it can balloon to just go through the roof and make no sense economically.
Right. And you are correct. And there's a lot of things we could go down on that rabbit hole with Michael. One of which is the fact that many universities are now in their admissions giving priority to first-generation college students. So, you know, people who come from families where people have not gone to college in the past. And, you know, of course, they claim that that's altruistic because you want to, you know, introduce that type of education to that family. But what that also does is it means that, number one, they don't question professors the way we questioned our professors, and they don't, you know, they don't question the cost because they don't know any better. You know, whereas when my children go to college, you know, you better believe I'm going to be questioning the cost.
Yeah.
And also when they come home with crazy stories from their professors, we're going to be able to, you know, tell them as my dad, you know, did that, you know, there's a reason some of these people are still, you know, college professors and they're not out in the real world.
that idea has been seemingly lost a little bit in the last generation.
It has. And that's, and some of that seems to be by design. But the point of this is that all of those problems, and the education problem also feeds into the housing problem, because these young people are tied up with all kinds of debt from their college experience, which makes affording that house even harder. And none of that is a result of capitalism.
Yeah, this is all the point of all of this is that, you know, that's actually anti-capitalism. It's the opposite of capitalism. It is government intervention in each of these systems, which is the heart of socialism. It's government intervention. It's the government telling the market it should work a certain way for whatever reason that it should. That means that costs and expense cannot be controlled in the natural way it's supposed to in a market. And you get these things that just no longer make sense. And it's not about capitalism. And then what a lot of the younger generation are told, the way they think that one could fix it, which is, again, this rise of socialism, this ride of democratic socialism or hard socialism, which is what I think of as Mamdami, which is just, you know, as socialist as you could be, you know, that will make all of these situations worse. It will not make it better. It actually makes them much worse.
It does make it worse. And I think this is an important thing to learn. And, you know, Michael, we've done probably a poor job in the past of encouraging our listeners and or viewers to, you know, do all the social media things you're supposed to do with podcasts, like them and share them and so forth. But I think this message needs to get out, and people do need to understand. We don't want to be, you know, we don't want to exaggerate it, but freedom is under pressure in the United States right now, and it's under pressure from both directions. So you've got things like Mamdami on the left. You've got, you know, things like, you know, our Vice President J.D. Vance coming out and saying that we should, you know, that we need to move away from a market. These are scary comments, and they're scary, situations for those of us who actually believe in freedom, regardless of what our political beliefs are. You know, in America, politics is played between the 40-yard lines, and right, left, liberal, conservative, we all believe in freedom. We all believe in a free market system. And it's important for us to defend it. And so one challenge I'll throw out there is that, you know, if anyone thinks there's an area where capitalism is not working for someone, by all means, send us that message. You can put it in the comments on YouTube. You can, if you have our contact information, you can contact us. And I guarantee you, I can show you that this is an area in our society where we have strayed from our free market principles. And the solution is usually not more government. In fact, government is almost always the problem.
Yeah. Well, Yeah, with that, I think that's it for this one. You know, as always, as Chuck said, leave us comments. Obviously, you can comment about this and that specific situation. But also, if there's anything you want to hear us talk about, please do. Also, share this to everyone. You know, it's very helpful for us if you share this on YouTube or anyone you think that might like it on YouTube and wherever you're listening to it. It's very helpful. And yeah, and we will talk to you again in about a month.
Chuck Osborne and Michael Smith are investment advisors, representative of Assured Partners Investment Advisors, LLC, a registered investment advisor. All statements and opinions expressed in this program are based upon information considered reliable, although statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information expressed does not consider the specific situation or objectives of any person and is not intended as a recommendation appropriate for any person. Viewers are encouraged to seek advice from a tax or legal professional or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk, and unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed.